Thank you, David. One thing that David failed to mention is that I am the Cato Institute's official rail nut. I love trains. I helped restore this steam locomotive, which is the second most powerful operating steam locomotive in the world, and is owned by the city of Portland, and it happened to be owned at one time by one of the few Western railroads that was built without any federal subsidies. But I'm not here to talk about steam locomotives as much as I enjoy doing it. I've been asked to talk about urban planners and government planners in general. Well, it turns out that government planners want to reshape how we live. They want to reshape where we live, where we work, where we shop, and how we travel around between working and shopping and home. You can see the effects of some of their plans by a law that was passed recently by the Washington State Legislature, which mandates a 50% reduction in per capita driving in the state of Washington by the year 2050. You can see the workings of urban planners in a plan written for the city of Portland in the early 1990s, which looked at Portland's area housing mix and found that at that time, 65% of Portland households lived in single-family homes and set a target to reduce that to 41%, so that 59% would be living in multifamily homes. Now, that's a smaller percentage of people living in single-family homes than is found in Tokyo, the world's largest megalopolis, one of the most dense urban areas in the world, and yet 45% of people in Tokyo, of households in Tokyo, live in single-family homes. Well, how are they going to accomplish these goals of reducing single-family home ownership and reducing automobile driving? Well, they have some techniques in mind. First, they want to put urban growth boundaries around cities. The state of Oregon has a law requiring every city in the state to have an urban growth boundary. Outside the urban growth boundaries, on 96% of the land in Oregon, you're not allowed to build a house on your own land unless you own at least 80 acres, you actually farm it, and you actually earn $40,000 to $80,000 per year, depending on the soil productivity, farming it for two of the last 3 years. Urban planners are proud of the fact that they've only gotten about 100 homes per year built in rural areas since these rules were put into effect. Inside the urban growth boundaries, they want to densify neighborhoods, increase the population density. So they've gone into neighborhoods of single-family homes and zoned them for apartments. And it's mandatory zoning. If your house burns down, you're not allowed to rebuild it. You're required to build an apartment or a row house or something else that meets the minimum density of the zone. Even row houses aren't enough to satisfy Portland planners. They want to have 4- and 5-story apartment buildings because that will provide the density that they think is necessary to for their ideal of how you should live. And in fact, they even support high-rise apartment buildings in many places. Portland planners are so intrusive on the way we live that they actually told this church that it could have no more than 70 people worship at one time in its 400-seat sanctuary, because letting more people in would require more driving, and they didn't want that to happen. Now, one of the other tools they use to achieve their goals is transit, and in particular, rail transit, such as this light rail line. Oh, excuse me. I thought that was in Portland. Whenever I see a red and white light rail line in front of an ugly apartment building, I think it's Portland. This is actually Moscow. Here's the one in Portland. Here's the one in Portland. I should have recognized the difference because in Moscow it's sunny and in Portland it's raining. Now, I don't want to say that nobody rides the light rail trains in Portland. But one day, a train came into downtown Portland with only one passenger on board. Now, coyotes like to go where they know they can find solitude from people. The truth is that before Portland started building light rail in 1980, 9.8% of all Portland area commuters took transit to work. Today, we have 5 light rail lines, a streetcar line, and a commuter rail line, and they've increased that all the way from 9.8% to 7.2%. The commuter rail line they built is so expensive that they could give every daily round-trip rider a Toyota Prius. Not just one Toyota Prius, but a new Toyota Prius every other year for the rest of their lives for less money than it costs to run the commuter train. And they're not alone at that. Nashville has a commuter train that is so expensive they could give every rider a new Toyota Prius every year for the rest of their lives rather than run the train. Even Portland planners admit that light rail makes no sense as far as transportation. Instead, they see it as a way to achieve higher densities. So when Portland built its first light rail line, they zoned all the land along the line for higher densities. 10 years later, this is what they got. Nothing. No new development along the line. And they asked developers why, and they said, people don't want to live that way. They want to live in single-family homes. You're not letting us build those, so that's what they'll buy. So they did what government always does when told that their dreams won't work. They started subsidizing it. Since then, Portland planners have given $2 billion in subsidies to developers to build high-density developments along the light rail line. Developments such as this one. Oh, excuse me, that's not in Portland. That's in the former East Germany. It was built in the Soviet era. Here's the one I meant to show you in Portland. The difference is that this one's slated to be torn down because as soon as the East Germans got their freedom, they moved to single-family homes. Whereas Portlanders no longer have the option of affordable single-family homes, so more people are living like this. Now, they call this a transit-oriented development because the train station is right behind this building, and they figure people are just going to walk to the station and go to where they need to go on the train. You see those cars parked there? See that little red sign? It says, no parking, fire lane. You see those cars parked there? See that red stripe? They're all parked on the sidewalk. The managers know that if they restricted people to the actual parking places, there's only 0.65 parking places per dwelling unit. So if they restricted people to the actual parking places, at least one-third of the people would move out because there's not enough parking for them. So they let people park, and they call it a transit-oriented development, but it turns out it's just as automobile-oriented as everywhere else in the Portland area. Now, the fact is that numerous studies have shown that these policies, what planners call smart growth, don't work. They don't reduce driving, per capita driving by 50%. They don't encourage people to live in high-density housing unless they absolutely have to. A study that came out of University of California, Irvine, found that there is a statistically significant link between driving and urban form, but it's too small to make any difference. If you're trying to save energy or reduce greenhouse gas emissions or anything like that, it's such a tiny link. And, you know, it might be statistically significant, but it might be like 0.1%. You double density and you reduce driving by a percentage or something like that. What these policies do is they make housing and land very expensive. This is a home in Houston. It's 4 bedrooms, 2.5 baths, 2,200 square feet of space on a quarter-acre lot. In 2005, it sold for $149,000. Now, that might not seem amazingly cheap if you're from the Midwest, but if you're from the coastal states, that seems pretty cheap. Now, due to the recession, the price went from $149,000 to $187,000 in 2011. Essentially, Houston, which doesn't have any of this planning, was immune from the effects of the recession. You want a house like that in Portland? Add $200,000 to the cost. You want a house like that in California, like San Jose or part of the San Francisco Bay Area? Add another $300,000 to the cost. And that's the post-recession cost. Before the recession, at the peak of the housing bubble, that house in Santa Fe was worth $1.4 million. Now, you might think that this kind of urban planning is a great example of federalism in action. because only about 16 states have passed laws like Oregon's and California's that limit where people can build their homes and limit and give urban planners huge amounts of power over people's lives. And as a result, those 16 states are the places where housing is expensive, and you can choose to go into one of the other states, such as Texas, where counties aren't even allowed to zone, much less plan, and still find affordable housing. Unfortunately, these policies tend to have a national significance, even though they're only in 16 states. Those 16 states happen to house about 45% of the population. You're all familiar with curves like this. This shows the housing bubble in three or four of the states that have rules like this. You can see that housing in about 2000 starting to shoot way up and then peaked about 2006 and then crashed, and then came the economic crash of 2008 that was a response to the decline in housing prices. The thing is, if you look at states that didn't have this kind of planning, you don't see this at all. Here's what housing prices look like in states like Texas and Georgia and North Carolina that do not have this kind of urban planning. You can see prices went up a little bit, and they did peak after the credit crisis in 2008, and then declined a little bit after that, but it's not a bubble, and if we hadn't had urban planning, we never would have had a bubble, we never would have had the credit crisis of 2008. The Fed, low interest rates on the part of the Fed, subprime loans, all those things were just as important in Texas as they were in Oregon and California, and yet they had no effect on housing prices, really. It was the land use planners who caused the bubble that led to the credit crisis. Now, there are some federal involvement in this. First of all, in the 1960s, the federal government ordered every metropolitan area in America to create a metropolitan planning organization. So if you live in Memphis, there's a Memphis Metropolitan Planning Organization that covers not just Memphis, but all the towns around Memphis. The Portland one covers 24 cities and three counties. The Metropolitan Planning Organizations were supposed to be a way to ease federal grant making. Instead of making grants to every little city and town in the country, they would just make them to the 400 Metropolitan Planning Organizations and make it easier. But urban planners found ways to use the Metropolitan Planning Organizations to get what they want, to convince a few of the cities to tell the other cities, unless you densify, unless you build light rail, we're not going to give you any of the federal dollars. Next, the federal government, Congress, in 1991, created some funds that I call open bucket funds for transportation, and particularly for transit. Highway funds are distributed using formulas based on land area, population, road miles, and things like that. So every state knows how much they're going to get. They don't have an incentive to waste money too much. The funds tend to be pretty efficiently spent. When they started handing out money for building rail transit, they created an open bucket fund they called the New Starts Fund. And basically they said cities that come in with really expensive transit proposals get lots of federal money. Cities that come in with really inexpensive transit proposals will not get much federal money. And if they're really inexpensive, you won't get any federal money. So it became a competition between cities to figure out how you can have the most wasteful transit system in America so you can get the most federal dollars. That worked really well, and now we have a Secretary of Immobility, Ray LaHood, the former Republican congressman from Illinois, who says he doesn't want cost effectiveness to be used to distribute federal dollars at all. He wants federal dollars to be distributed solely on the basis of what he calls livability, which means living without automobiles. The latest trend is to build streetcar lines everywhere because it's going to do so much for our livability to have a 7-mile-an-hour streetcar running around the streets of our cities. You can go out here and look a block away from here and look at the streetcars through Memphis, go through family dollar stores and boarded up storefronts and see just how much they've contributed to the livability of Memphis. So there is some federal involvement, but most of it has come from the local level, from local urban planners going to their legislatures, asking the legislatures and persuading the legislatures to give them power over their states and it's been particularly successful in the Pacific Coast states and some of the Atlantic Coast states and New England states as well. I talk about all these things in several of my books. I did bring a few copies of The Best Laid Plans with me, which talks about both land use and transportation issues. If anybody wants to buy one, I'll be glad to make them available. Of course, they're also available at cato.org and on Amazon and in Kindle editions and everything else. Thank you very much.